Join us on a voyage of discovery with Mohlomi Kekeletso Maobane as we peel through the annals of South African football folklore. Come along for the journey. Show your love, know your game.
The indomitable lions of Cameroon who put Africa on the map. The 1990 FIFA World Cup, hosted by Italy, marked the coming of age of African football on the global stage, thanks to the heroics of the legendary indomitable lions of Cameroon. The FIFA World Cup is the biggest spectacle in the world. Held every 4 years, the tournament started in 1930 and pits countries affiliated to FIFA against each other for the highest honor in football. Brazil, the country that gifted the world with the prodigious talent of Edison Arantes do Nascimento, commonly known as Pele, is the most successful World Cup country, as they have lifted the Jules Rimet trophy 5 times. Germany's Die Mannschaft is the second most successful country with 4 trophies to their name. Coming to Italia 90, it was Brazil's South America rivals, Argentina, who were amongst the firm favourites. Le Albiceleste were in a purple patch. They had won their first World Cup as a host country in 1978, were eliminated in the second round in the 1982 Mundial, and won the title again in 1986. That 86 triumph is one of the most iconic FIFA World Cup tournaments ever. It was, after all, in Mexico 86 where Maradona ascended to a god. El Pibe de Oro, Spanish for the Golden Boy, and his immortality in the quarterfinal against England when he scored 2 of the most famous goals in football. Played on the 22nd June 1986 at Mexico City Estadio Azteca. For the first goal, Maradona cunningly used his hand to score what became known as the Hand of God. The second goal was also the stuff of classics and was crowned as the goal of the century. Maradona's heroics in that tournament rightly won him the Golden Boot Award, which is awarded to the best player in the World Cup. And thus, coming to the 1990 World Cup 4 years later, with Maradona still leading the charges, Argentina were expected to defend their title. The South Americans were drawn into Group B with Cameroon, Romania and Russia. As was customary between 1974 and 2002, as defending champions of the World Cup, Argentina would play in the opening match. Their opponents for the first game at the San Siro Stadium in Milan were the West Africans. It would be misleading to say Cameroon was underrated. That would suggest they were rated in the first place. This is not to say the indomitable Lions had no football pedigree. Going into the 1990 World Cup, Cameroon had been continental champions as recent as the 1984 and 1988 African Nations Cup tournaments. The West Africans had also given a good account of themselves at club level in intercontinental competitions. The premier African club tourney is the African Champions League. At its inception in 1965, it was known as the African Champions Cup, pitting champions of each country against each other. The inaugural winner was Oryx Douala, a side from Cameroon's largest city and economic hub. The original trophy of the African Champions Cup was known as the Osekafio Cup, eponymously named after its donor, the revered African leader Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Kenyon Yaounde lifted the cherished trophy in 1971, 1978 and 1980, while Union Touahla won it in 1979. The second prominent club tournament in Africa is the African Cup Winners' Cup. It started in 1975, contested by cup winners across the continent, and is now known as the Confederations Cup after it was merged with the CAF Cup in 2004. Cameroonian sides had won it 3 times by 1990. Tonere Yaounde in 1975, Kanon Yaounde in 1979, and Union Touahla in 1981. Cameroonian players had also excelled individually. Roger Milly in 1976, Thomas Nkono in 1979 and 1982, Jean Manga Ongwene in 1980, and Théophile Abega were all crowned the best footballers in Africa in the years referred to. Despite this credible record, Cameroon was not given a whiff of a chance, not only against Argentina in the opening game of Italia 90, but in the competition as a whole. A cursory study of the history of FIFA and its most lucrative and prized asset, the World Cup, enlightens us where this underrating comes from. The International Federation of Association Football, FIFA, was formed in 1904 by officials from France, Belgium, Denmark, Netherlands, Germany, Spain, Sweden, and Switzerland. The organization now stands at 211 members, making it bigger in size than the United Nations. The World Cup, FIFA's prominent event, kicked off in 1930, but Africa would only start participating at the Second World Cup, which was hosted by Italy in 1934. Egypt was the continent's sole representative in Italy. Africa would have no participant again in the World Cup until the 1970 tournament in Mexico. A brief glimpse at the 1966 World Cup in England offers some insight how this came to play. In 1964, during the build-up to the qualifying rounds for the 1966 World Cup, FIFA drew up new regulations which compelled the winner of the Africa zone to play against either the Asia or Oceania zone to qualify for the World Cup. Headed by Englishman Stanley Rowe, a man unashamedly sympathetic to the apartheid cause, what this new FIFA regulation meant is that three continents would only have one representative in the world's premier football tournament. 4 years later, the controversial rule was withdrawn, and Africa had its first guaranteed representative at the World Cup. Be that as it may, as it still does today, there was no mistaking who the tournament was biased towards numerically. If we discounted England and Mexico, who qualified automatically as defending champion and host respectively. Of the 14 teams that participated in the tournament, 8 were from Europe, 3 from South America, 1 from Africa, 1 from the Caribbean, and 1 from Asia or Oceania. Morocco, Africa's sole representative, finished bottom of Group 4 after 1 draw and 2 losses. Zaire was Africa's next representative at the Mundial in Germany 1974. Becoming the first sub-Saharan country to play in the tournament. It was an unforgettable showing. Zaire lost their opening match against Scotland 2-0, a score considered respectable for the debutants. From there on, it went pear-shaped. The next game was against Yugoslavia, and the Africans were walloped 9-0, a record losing margin that stands to this day. Such was Zaire's dismal performance. One writer even suggested that the score flattered the Central African country. 2 games, 2 losses, 11 goals conceded, and out of the tournament. There was still the small matter of the last game to be played, against none other than the reigning champions, Brazil. The predicted annihilation seemed to be on course when Jairzinho put the South Americans ahead in the 13th minute. 54 minutes later, there was another Brazilian goal, but it was deep into the second half that Zaire made a lasting impression at the world stage. Brazil won a free kick just outside their opponent's 18-yard area, and as they were lining up to take the free kick, Moape Ilunga raced from the defensive wall and hoofed the ball up the field. It was the most bizarre moment, Ilunga earning himself a yellow card and infamy. In the build-up to the tournaments, the Africans had been typically derided with claims that their massive entourage incorporated several witch doctors and their diet included monkeys. And now here was one of their players acting in a manner which BBC commentator John Watson infamously described as a bizarre moment of African ignorance. The match eventually ended 3-0, bringing Zaire's first and so far only World Cup safari to an end. It had been an unforgettable first showing for sub-Saharan Africa. With the benefit of hindsight, we have learned how misplaced this self-congratulatory bigotry was. Zaire gained independence from Belgium in 1960, and 5 years later, typically with the backing of his Western masters, Mobutu Sese Seko snatched power in a coup. In the 70s, Mobutu decided to invest significant resources into football. This culminated in Zaire not only winning the African Nations Cup in 1974, but also qualifying for the World Cup in West Germany. Mobutu was elated. The lepers were invited to his grandiose compound and each player awarded a house and a green Volkswagen Beetle for this achievement. After the opening match against Scotland, which was generally accepted as a credible showing, things went pear-shaped, the reasons for the implosion setting precedents that continue to bedevil African football half a century later. In the build-up to the second match against Yugoslavia, the Zairean cap imploded as players did not receive their match payments, suspecting that their monies had been fleeced by some members of the million or so hangers-on that were part of the entourage. The players were adamant that they would not honour the fixture, prompting FIFA to step in and ensure each of the players were paid their 3,000 deutschmarks. The damage, however, had been done. The squabble had knocked the wind out of the team's sail, leading to a 9-0 hiding. The despotic Mobutu sent his notorious presidential guard to threaten the players that if they lost the match against Brazil by more than 4 goals, they would be denied entry back into their country. And thus, when Ilunga hoofed the ball forward against Brazil, the action was not informed by ignorance of football rules. Brazil was already 2-0 up, and Ilunga was buying time to ensure that the Brazilians don't score a third and possibly a fourth goal that would lead to the players being denied entry into their country by the ruthless despot who passed for their president. With the game finishing 3-0, the players were allowed to return home, but they had lost the last they earned earlier that year as African champions. As aforementioned, Mobutu's involvement in this episode archetypically set Africa back. The majority of the pioneers from the 1974 Zaire team were consigned into a life of poverty when they retired. And as seen with South Africa at the 2002 World Cup in Asia and the Ghanaian national team at the 2016 Mundial in Russia, squabbles over money between players and officials is as common as bloated entourage among African representatives at the World Cup. However, after 1974, African teams steadily but surely started making credible inroads in the World Cup, and in the process, once again forcing FIFA to make amendments on how it governed the game. At the 1978 World Cup, Tunisia was Africa's sole representative. They beat Mexico 3-1 in their opening match. This was not only Africa's first victory at the Mundial, but significantly, going to the 1982 World Cup in Spain, it forced FIFA to increase the number of participants in the World Cup from 16 to 24, with Africa getting another spot. Spain hosted the World Cup in 1982, with Algeria and Cameroon representing Africa. Algeria made history when they beat European champions West Germany 2-1. This was the first African victory over European oppositions. The Algerians were built to make it to the second round, but the Germans and Austrians contrived to play to a 1-0 result in what was clearly a fixed match that is known as the Disgrace of Gijón. Had the Germans won by a higher margin, Algeria would have qualified. But the Europeans, seeing that the 1-0 scoreline suited them both, with 80 minutes remaining, contrived to aimlessly kick the ball around with no tackle, sprints, crosses or shots at goal. Subsequently, FIFA changed its laws, stating that all the last two games in the group stages of the World Cup will be played simultaneously. In 1986, Morocco became the first African team to not only reach the knockout stages, but also to finish top of their group. In 1986, Morocco became the first African team to not only reach the knockout stages, but also the first to finish top of their group. Going into the 1990 World Cup, this was the history Africa had with FIFA generally and the World Cup specifically. It was a checkered and strained relationship, underpinned by a European football fraternity that underestimated Africans as a people and footballers. It was for this reason that the Argentina vs. Cameroon match was seen as a mere formality. For many of their players, it's a huge opportunity to perform in front of such a huge audience. They seemed almost overawed by the sheer size of the stadium when they were taking pictures earlier on, said one of the commentators before the match started. Once the game kicked off, the fallacy of this underestimation became apparent. Argentina were first off the blocks and had made two attempts at goal by the third minute. However, contrary to the commentators' patronizing remarks, Cameroon were not overawed by the occasion and were going toe-to-toe with their much-fancied opponents and were matching them pound for pound. On the 22nd minute, it took two Argentinian defenders to scramble and clear from the line a chance by Makinaki. All this time, the best player in the world was having a quiet match. An exceptional talent like Maradona cannot, however, be subdued for a whole game. And he proved his worth on the 28th minute with an exquisite pass for Jorge Paracuga. The Argentinian captain nonchalantly chipped a ball over the Cameroonian defense, creating the best defense of the half as Paracuga found himself one-on-one with the Cameroonian keeper. But once again, Thomas Nkono showed us why he's one of the greatest, making a save with his legs. Neri Pumpido, in the Argentinian goals, was also made to earn his money when he had to make an acrobatic save from a fierce shot by Francois Oman Pig. The first half finished 0-0, and both sides were more or less matching each other. In the second stanza, Cameroon continued defying odds, not falling over their fancied opponents, rather taking the game to them. The turning point truly arrived in the 62nd minute when André Canapig was given his marching orders for tripping Claudio Caniggia. Now with a one-man advantage, surely Argentina would finally unlock the stubborn Cameroonian defense. It did not take long for the duck to be broken. Just 5 minutes after Pig was sent off, the score was 1-0. It was, however, not the revered world champions who had scored. Francois Omar Pig, older brother of André, who had just been sent off, rose majestically inside the box and headed down a Cyril Makinaki cross that Neri Pumpido could only parry into his goal. Cameroon 1, Argentina 0. With 23 minutes to go, there was still enough time left in the game for both sides. Could Cameroon protect their lead? Or would the world champions salvage a draw or even a victory? Both sides continued attacking each other relentlessly, although, naturally, the Argentinians were more offensive as they sought that elusive goal. Cameroon were then reduced to 9 men when Benjamin Massing received marching orders for his infamous tackle on Claudio Caniggia. Argentina now had an advantage of 2 extra players. But time was running out and the Africans were not rolling over. Late in the game, Cameroon found themselves 2-on-2. But alas, instead of scoring for Roger Miller, who was free in the box, Emile Mbowe hoofed the ball deep into the grandstand. Definitely a missed opportunity. But it did not matter. A minute later, Michel Vautrot blew the whistle 3 times to signal the end of the match. And that's how the match ended. Cameroon 1, Argentina 0. The indomitable Lions of Cameroon had caused the biggest upset ever in world football. Every so often, sports gifts mankind with unforgettable moments that transcend athletic itself. Queen Serena's reign will last forever, inspiring millions of future generations long after she has stopped majestically straddling tennis courts. The greatest, Muhammad Ali, taught us in The Rumble in the Jungle that boxing was also about brains, not just brawn. While the 1995 Orlando Pirates team taught us the importance of never losing faith, even when the stakes are pegged against you. The indomitable Lions of Cameroon equally made an enduring imprint with not only their victory against Argentina, but their phenomenal run to the quarterfinals of the World Cup in Italia 90. Africa arrived on the football stage globally with that campaign. Most importantly, what the Cameroon national team did in 1990 is show many Africans that they are second to none, not only in football, but in any sphere of life.
My name is Mohlomi Kekeletso Maobane. I am a writer with a particular interest in South African and African football. My view of the game of football is predominantly historic. Documenting football has been, without a doubt, the most fulfilling thing I have ever done. To paraphrase the writer Corey Brand Penn, the game has been good to me and preserved my youth. Not only did it capture my goals, it told me the truth.